Hello and welcome to the Compliance Week podcast. I'm Joe Mott, staff writer for Compliance Week. We're chatting today with Daniel Wager, Vice President for Financial Crime and Compliance and Global Market Strategy at LexisNexis Risk Solutions. We talked to him about the challenges inherent in sanctions compliance. Wager is an experienced financial crime compliance and investigations executive. He has held several positions in top financial institutions, including HSBC and TD Bank. Prior to that, he was a supervisory special agent at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and a special agent with the U.S. Customs Service and the Department of the Treasury. Our first question, how difficult is sanctions compliance, given its constantly changing nature, evolving OFAC lists, and with so much political uncertainty around the globe? Is compliance as difficult as it seems, given all the moving pieces?
It is difficult. It is a space that has been an area of significant focus by financial institutions over the last couple of decades. However, the attention has increasingly focused upon the non-financial financial services space for corporates. And that is for a number of reasons. It's because of the evolution of the laws and the regulations. It's also because of the evolution of the global commerce space, and it's important in achieving compliance to achieve policy aims under the sanctions regimes. And to your question, the nature of sanctions is constantly changing. From an original form where it was principally published in the form of OFAC, specially designated national lists, that were fairly straightforward and prescriptive in nature, although they weren't always full of identification information, which created challenges for corporations. But they have evolved significantly to include sectoral sanctions targeting areas such as the Crimea and Russia, which are very different in the way that they're implemented and different in the way that they are enforced. Recent sanctions against Venezuela followed a similar stream, but again, they while they in part involved especially designated national lists on the OFAC list, also included sectoral type of measures to include measurements of ownership and control. And finally, there are some very big variances in the most recent evolutions of sanctions by the government, including the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, or CATA, which was signed into law by the President in August 2017, which targets some familiar targets, it's Russia and Iran, but importantly brings a very different angle to enforcement of sanctions against goods tied to North Korea.
What can firms look for in terms of the red flags that a bad actor is seeking to bypass sanctions restrictions? What do these warning signs look like for a non-financial firm?
The financial industry, in fact, as you point out, does have a significant amount of mastery in this space, but it's important to note that the financial services sector itself has been evolving into payment spaces and fintech spaces where transactions occur with customers in ways that were not envisioned years ago and have required significant change to have comprehensive compliance programs. But for the red flags, which have been well fleshed out in literature from bank examiners, from OFAC itself, and shared amongst compliance professionals in the financial services sector and non-financial services sector. Some very basic ones are understood by most. And they would include a reluctance to provide info by a customer or a counterparty as to where goods are coming from, who is paying, nationalities involved, methods of shipping, conflicting information. When someone is asked for information and identification information doesn't match claims nationality or residence, or frequent changes to information that creates conflict, such as the contact persons or contact numbers or emails. But one that I would point out that's a very, very good one for all compliance professionals would be looking for asymmetry. And that asymmetry involves payments or shipping destinations or locations that do not tie together, meaning payment may arise from one source in one country for goods being shipped to a different destination, or the request for goods to be transshipped. When there's asymmetry in who is paying versus who is receiving, there can be a very legitimate commercial explanation, but it has come to be seen as a very important flag because this is the method that the bad actors, as you described them applicably, use to evade sanctions regimes. And we at LexisNexis Risk Solutions have focused on identifying data points and assisting our customers with identifying these through screening of their data to identify the asymmetry and the potential risk therein.
How has risk-appropriate screening of customers evolved within the banking world? What are the challenges and pitfalls?
Risk, as you know, and as your listeners know, risk-appropriate measures is a mantra that's quite accepted in the trade at this point. At times, there are feelings in the industry that risk-appropriate is not always interpreted in the same way by enforcement agencies versus regulators versus compliance professionals. But risk-appropriate is the goal, and that's very important in the sanction space. While banks have regulators that require the maintenance of sanctions programs have very high standards and examine to those points, there infrequently are people within non-financial services corporates, which are the bulk of the world's commerce space in the movement of goods and services, who very rarely are there individuals there who are examining to those same points and helping someone establish what is risk appropriate. And that is important because, in fact, no one, no entity, no company is without sanctions risk unless they are an extraordinarily insular entity that services a very small space. The mom-and-pop grocery store on the corner may have zero or minimal sanctions risk. But very quickly, in the global commerce space for corporations, sanctions risk under a strict liability regime, which means that, most simply, it doesn't matter if you knew, it doesn't matter if you had a program, it doesn't matter what your intention was. If you ship a good or facilitate a sanctions violation, you expose your company to potential enforcement action, fines, and penalties. So risk appropriate has evolved significantly in the banking world and has somewhat settled, but risk appropriate is still being explored in the corporate space, particularly the global commerce space. And in that space, it is very difficult because they do not have all the same information about the people that supply them, the people that that facilitate their activities, work with them to achieve payments, or the people receiving goods that a bank has. So risk appropriate for a corporation that is not a bank is significantly different, but it's a very important point for them to work out because you don't want to implement a solution that overclubs or overwhelms the company. That does no good. It's no good.
Companies, he says, must formulate a long-term response to sanctions. We asked Wager to dig deeper into this observation and the differences between short-term and long-term approaches.
That point highlights, again, the differences between the financial services sector and the non-financial services corporate sector in that banks have had a long term to develop this response with significant amounts of guidance and a significant amount of enforcement activity, the ability to look at others who have suffered and learn lessons from them. Now, there's been a lot of transference of talent amongst those entities, but what we're seeing now is that talent is also moving into the global commerce space, the non-financial services space, to help those companies deal and develop a long-term response. To get back to your original question about the long-term response and the necessity for it, the impact it could have on outcomes, first and foremost, you have to have a program. If your company sources globally, sells globally, or builds things which include components that come to you internationally, you need to have a program and a plan. And that begins to begin that road on that long-term response. You begin by assessing your risk and exposure, looking at your customer base, deciding on your risk appetite, and beginning by implementing meaningful programs that you can achieve. Meaning, if you have billions upon billions of customers, well, you can implement solutions. We have assisted entities with implementing solutions to look at billions of parties involved and even look back at billions of parties. But that's not where you want to begin. You want to begin with a policy and an assessment, a risk appetite statement, and then a meaningful, executable solution, which is what we focus on at LexisNexis Risk Solutions, is to helping our clients identify those meaningful solutions that will not bury them as they start that journey. And then you move to enhance as you see additional risk or in response to developments in the industry or feedback from regulatory and enforcement agencies.
If companies don't have adequate processes in place to monitor who they do business with, they risk being sanctioned themselves. How can a company make sure they don't fall into that trap? How is technology best leveraged?
So that question, yet again, brings out important differences between the financial services side and the global commerce or other corporate spaces. Banks have been compelled through enforcement action and regulatory pressure to deploy resources. And while some may not always agree on the adequacy of them, while there always will be natural tension with a bank within banks over what looks adequate, we have moved with our customers because we've seen the force in the industry to develop operationally efficient responses and operationally efficient solutions so that even in a paucity of resources scenario, you can address the risk that you have. Where this has gotten difficult, Joe, is first in the evolution of financial services into fintech and other spaces where many companies are starting very quickly and growing in their transactional or customer base, transactional velocity or customer base very fast. And in those scenarios, building out a meaningful sanctions compliance program may fall behind other business priorities. So there's risk there, and some players in the industry are doing a great job of addressing it. Now, in corporate, non-financial services, there are particular pressures about adequate resourcing. In that every, just as in a bank where compliance is a cost center, it's highlighted as being even more so in a corporation because it's not required by regulation. And just to point out an oddity of the sanctions world, whereas many aspects of the Bank Secrecy Act and anti-money laundering laws and the Patriot Act and others demand that certain measures be taken. When it comes to sanctions, it's very simple. The law says you may not violate. You must not violate. So while regulators demand banks do certain things in sanction space, corporations have no such pressure. There is no regulator there standing over their head saying, you must put these resources and conduct these processes. So in many of those cases, the compliance officers have a even more significant battle in getting resources to address sanctions risk absent a regulatory requirement. I would highlight to show you the some of the worst cases. Of course, everyone can point to all the compliance professionals that listen to your broadcast, understand the incredible penalties that have been in place against banks. Interestingly, as the large banks and mid-sized banks and even the small ones have in place compliance programs addressing sanctions risk, the bad actors have moved to different places. And it doesn't always come from the obvious places like Iran. By way of example, Jennifer Shasky-Calvary, who was the former head of FinCEN, when FinCEN, together with the National Credit Union Administration, moved against a Florida credit union and shut it down and placed a significant penalty and closed the credit union, they highlighted specifically that bad actors are looking to find places where there's inadequate resources. So the damage to your question about what is the risk, well, in that case, that credit union was shuttered. his employees were let go. And it was because it was processing transactions for very high-risk places. Now, that same thing has happened in the corporate space, and it is very natural for government agencies, from FinCEN, from the enforcement and regulatory side, as well as the agencies that investigate, such as Department of Homeland Security, such as the FBI, IRS, and others, when they get done looking at banks and they find new targets, they're finding them more and more in the corporate space. So the corporates, non-financial services, corporate space, reputational risks are huge penalties, fines and penalties, the potential for requirements about forcibly implementing programs or the emplacement of monitors as parts of settlement agreements, legal costs that can be astronomical. And then you have the less tangible, much more difficult to calculate impact to brand reputation, shareholder value, and importantly, what many corporates don't understand is the loss of what's called a first violation credit, which OFAC may give a company for, particularly if they self-identify their issues, but on the first violation, you often get treated better than if you've been warned once. So for companies who have not had programs in place, the risk can be extraordinarily large.
How concerning is third-party risk and the sanctions or money laundering violations that could take place somewhere along the supply chain or among the network of partners and associated entities?
So in the financial services sector, there's been significant and long-term attention to third-party risk, and this is part of the pressures that have driven many global correspondent banks to sever relationships or cut off entities because the customer's customer and the non-transparency that the nature of that relationship presents poses significant risk. But for global corporations, particularly in the global commerce space, and this would include companies that buy, sell, service or incorporate components anywhere in the world from the U.S. or even foreign companies who trade on U.S. exchanges or have financial connections to the U.S., their supply chain risk is quite incredible. And I mentioned earlier CATA, which is the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, which was passed into law last year. And if anyone that's listening has not read CATA, particularly CATSA Section 321, they should do so if they work for any kind of company, because that section says specifically that if any component, any precursor material, any element, whether it was human labor or whether it was an item procured by or manufactured or refined by any North Korean national anywhere in the world, and it does not distinguish between North Korean nationals living in different countries. It does not distinguish between North Korean nationals who are refugees in other countries. It says that if a North Korean national helped to produce a component or an item in your supply chain, that you may be held viable under multiple sections of sanction law because of the risk posed by the North Korean regime and what has been identified as the positioning of North Korean labor around the world to bring capital back to North Korea. So many companies, this could be as simple as a bakery in the middle of the United States that produces bread for a large number of states, but it feels its risk is very low, could turn out that a piece of machinery or the sugar it uses or the salt it puts into its bread comes through a supply chain that ultimately goes back, there is liability and risk in there. And there have not been CATSA enforcement actions in this space here, but you certainly don't want to be the first company to be the test case to see how large these penalties will be.
We asked Wager what lessons could he share from both his time in the banking sector and with the government.
My first suggestion would be to restate something I said a few minutes ago, which is, the most important step is to assess whether you have sanctions risk. And it should be with an eye to understanding that almost no one has no sanctions risk if you are a company that deals in the global commerce space. So first is assessing your risk and developing a program. That immediately will put you ahead of peers and place you in a better position if you implement that program, even at a basic level, even just to begin screening your vendors, even just to analyzing your supply chain for risky elements related to North Korea or other places. Have the program and begin implementing it. It puts you ahead of the pack. The second point I would make would be an important one about people understanding that we don't interact with the government much, or I deal with commodities that are very low risk and don't gather government attention. I don't sell jet fighter components or other things. And that's a great point, because those sorts of industries have been under scrutiny for a long time. But remember, the government arrives at enforcement actions and begins investigations in myriad ways. It could be an informant. It could be because a counterparty to a transaction has been highlighted as being of concern. Back to that asymmetry I mentioned, someone that pays you for some goods may also have bought some fighter components from someone else, and they have now pointed the government in your direction. The government may be looking at banking transactions. It might be using intelligence information to generate cases. But it's important to note that the lack of prior action by the government in your space, or lack of prior interest in your commodities or goods, is not a good indicator of your sanctions risk. And then the final one I would mention, Joe, would be a reminder about once you've implemented, assessed your risks, implemented a program in meaningful ways, it is very important that in conjunction with legal counsel, competent, capable legal counsel with sanctions experience, that companies consider the incredible value of self-identification, where a company identifies violations, the extent of violations, puts in measures to stop repeated violations, and in a timely and appropriate manner self-identifies those violations to government. Because as the banking sector very much understands, but less so in the non-bank corporate side, self-identification to OFAC can lead to discounts of penalties of up to 50% or even more. So by statute, it can be up to 50%. So it's very important that that self-identification happen, but those other items I mentioned must come first, because you don't want to self-identify and still be violating or have no program.
That's all the time we have. We've been chatting with Daniel Wager, Vice President for Financial Crime and Compliance and Global Market Strategy for LexisNexis Risk Solutions. Thank you for listening, and I hope you join us again next time.